Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Tell me where we are.
Specifically in a storage closet of the Tikanda School, surrounded by boxes of cereal and huge cans of baked beans, refried beans.
A pantry. We're in a pantry.
We're in a well-stocked pantry, I might add. Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Coming up, find out why Zach Hughes and Davis Hovey are in a pantry. But first, I should welcome you to the Iditapod. It's a podcast, my friends, about the Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we dig in, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Well, some Iditarod controversy related to dogs and drugs bubbling up. We had that in yesterday's episode, talking about a confrontation at the restart of the race Sunday in Willow. Today, though, a few less controversial items. Our trail reporters, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes and KNOM's Davis Hovey, you heard them lead off today's Iditapod. They have reports on how the mushers decide where to take their mandatory 24-hour layover and how teams are doing with fatigue on a snowy, slower-going trail. And we're going to talk about food. I know it's one of my favorite subjects, but first, a quick update on how the race is shaping up at the front. As I'm recording this here Thursday morning, we have two Norwegian mushers into the checkpoint of Iditarod. They are Yor Leifseth Olsom and Lars Monsen. Olsom arrived about 8:30 last night with all 16 dogs in harness. He wins the Dorothy G. Page Halfway Award and $3,000 in gold nuggets. He also appears to be taking his mandatory 24-hour layover. I don't know that for a fact, but right now it's been over 9 hours that he's been there, and I'm assuming that he's going to be staying for a full 24. Hasn't done that yet. And Iditarod seems like kind of a cool place to be doing that. It's a ghost town. It was once a bustling community of over 10,000 people, and it was the heart of the Iditarod mining district. That's where the trail got its name. Dog teams were crucial back in the day for hauling supplies, mail, and even left with gold. According to the Iditarod, between 1908 and 1925, about $35 million in gold was taken from the area, most of it by dog team. So that connection to gold mining is why Olsom wins $3,000 in gold nuggets. He doesn't have to carry that with him all the way to Nome, but someone will be taking care of it. And like I said, his fellow Norwegian Lars Monsen has also joined Olsom in Iditarod. Meanwhile, back up the trail, defending champ Mitch Seavey was the first to complete his 24-hour layover. He left the village checkpoint of Takatna about 25 minutes before midnight. Seavey was trailed out of Takatna by Nicholas Petit, Aaron Burmeister, Ray Reddington Jr., Jesse Royer, Ali Zirkel, among many others. They are all through Ophir, along with Linwood Fiedler, Pete Kaiser, Richie Deal, Wade Mars, and Kelly Maxner. The race is still shaping up here, with other teams still to take their 24-hour rest. Once those are complete, you'll have a better picture of kind of where the leapfrogging is going to occur, who really is in the lead. And one of the key components in Mushers Iditarod strategies is where they opt to take that mandatory 24-hour rest. Some declare it early in McGrath, others push up to Takatna, and a few bold ones push their luck driving their teams toward Ophir and all the way to Iditarod, like Olsom, it looks like. We have a story from Zach here looking at two very different options, Takatna and Ophir, to find out what the considerations are that mushers are weighing when they opt to sit still for a whole day.
Generally, the most popular checkpoint to 24 is Takatna, renowned for its hospitality, comfortable accommodations, and pies. It's also extremely well set up for a long-term stay, with dog teams parked up and down a roomy hillside that's out of the way of foot traffic and snow machines. Linwood Fiedler says it's just more comfortable than the other options up or down the trail.
Well, you certainly get better fed here. You don't have to make your own food, which is nice, and the community is so supportive here. Water's for your dogs is so easy, and so there's a lot of creature comforts here.
There's also a decent setup for sleeping in the community's small church, some of the first real rest in days for many racers. Takatna is also well-positioned strategically. For mushers planning out moves 3 and 4 steps ahead, like Cody Straith, the town is an excellent launching point for the austere runs on the way to the Yukon River.
Right when you leave here, it's precisely 100 miles to Iditarod.
So that's a good distance to split in half for your first start. You don't want to start with mega runs. You do 250-mile runs. Conveniently, there's a shelter cabin 50 miles in, so you don't even have to sleep on the ground. So once you get the Iditarod, it's roughly another 50 miles to Shagaluk and so on. It kind of sets you up perfectly for getting out here if you were to stay.
And there's camaraderie in Takotna. Mushers sit shoulder to shoulder with one another at a table in the bustling community center where hot meals are dished out. Straith says that mentally, there's just a little boost from getting to talk with other mushers and comparing notes.
It's nice to have a couple conversations and see that other people are going through the same things.
Takotna is really easy and comfortable, but it's just really busy. So it just seems like the dogs rest better here because there's not so many people.
Anna Barrington made it to Ophir before declaring her 24. And even though it's only about 24 miles away, compared to Takotna, it feels like a semi-abandoned wilderness outpost, which it sort of is. There's a small hunting cabin surrounded by some outbuildings. Nobody lives in Ophir. It's more like a landmark than a town. Mushers can sleep in a wall tent, or if you're Martin Boozer, you've got a backup strategy.
I have my tent with me too. If it gets crowded, I'll just whip out my tent and call it a privacy trip.
Boozer is mixing up a meal for his team, dropping chunks of frozen pre-cut meat into a bucket with kibble. Even though there are some snow machines zooming by and the whir of a pesky drone as it buzzes overhead, he's made Ophir a frequent destination for his 24 because of the quiet. He says it makes better rest for dogs, and while it's nice being fed, his wife packs him plenty of high-quality trail meals that he prefers to make on his own.
Shrimp, steak, peas, corn, poppy seed muffins. I have a little bit of everything in every checkpoint.
As for the other creature comforts he's forgoing in Ophir, Boozer says he thought that was the whole point of the Iditarod.
Well, it's a dog race, you know, it's not. I guess that's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what I expected to do when I started the race. So.
Once mushers come off their 24s, they have another mandatory rest for 8 hours they can take at any checkpoint along the Yukon, and another one in White Mountain, 77 miles from Nome. In Ophir and Takotna, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
So they're eating, they're resting, but the wear and tear of the trail is starting to show in a couple teams further back in the standings. Upon racing more than 300 miles of trail into the checkpoint of McGrath, that's a little bit farther back, the 2018 Yukon Quest champion, Alan Moore, noticed that his younger, inexperienced team is starting to fatigue.
My goal is to try to get as many dogs to the finish line as possible, no matter how long it takes. So when they get tired, like they're a little tired on this run, and they've never ran 7 hours before, well, I'm resting. If I had a little bit more mature dogs, I'd kept going through. But they're little tarts. We're resting here a little while, and then we'll go on.
For several years, Moore and his mushing and kennel partner, Allie Zirkel, his wife, they've used a strategy of running their A-team in the Quest. Like I said, Moore won it this year. And then Zirkel will take those dogs in the Iditarod, while Moore takes more of a training run with younger dogs. So he's maybe not trying to win the Iditarod this year, but he is definitely trying to take care of those younger dogs so that they can become perhaps champions later on. So while in McGrath, Moore was giving a few of them extra tape around their shins as a way to prevent injuries. Parallel park to him in McGrath was rookie Andy Pohl's team of 15 dogs. They were sleeping on hay piles with some extra blankets around just for good measure. Pohl points out that sometimes it's not necessarily the dogs that are the worst for wear along the way.
It's more the musher. I think the musher gets beat up more than the dogs do. Being a rookie, I guess getting thrown into it a little more. The dogs sure do bounce off a lot of stuff, whether it's going through some of the wallows created by the snow machines in the trail, soft snow conditions. We haven't had too much ice yet. That'll probably be later. But they're doing great.
Pohl is one of 16 rookies competing in this year's Iditarod, and with only 2 scratches so far, none of them have been rookies. Today, Pohl is only a couple places behind Nenana's Jesse Holmes, the Iditarod rookie that is the highest up in the standings as of right now. And we have a question today from an Iditarod race fan rookie. It's a voice memo sent to us by email, and the subject line is, "I'm following dog sledding now?"
Good morning, Iditapod. This is Heather from California. Yesterday, Mitch CV talked about changing out his sled for an alternate sled. How do alternate sleds get to and from the checkpoints, and how many times are mushers allowed to do this during the race? Thank you.
That's a great question, and you do see mushers switching out sleds sometimes. Often it's when they get to the coast, they want maybe a different style sled. They might not need to carry as many dogs at that point if they've dropped some. To answer the part about how the replacement sleds get out there, they are flown out like just about everything else, including drop bags and other supplies that the checkpoint volunteers need. Pretty much everything except for the mushers, the dogs, and then the sleds that they leave Willow on. And I'm just going to go ahead and read from the Iditarod's rules about this in my rule keeper's voice. A musher has a choice of sled subject to the requirement that some type of sled or toboggan must be drawn. The sled or toboggan must be capable of hauling any injured or fatigued dogs under cover, plus equipment and food. Braking devices must be constructed to fit between the runners and not to extend beyond the tails of the runners. No more than 3 sleds can be used by a musher during the race after the restart. No more than 2 sleds can be shipped beyond the restart. Should a musher use another musher's sled for any reason, that will be considered one of the 3 allowable sleds. These sleds may be used at the musher's discretion. Sleds or mushers may not be assisted with sails or wheels. Interesting. Ski poles are allowed. No other sled exchanges are permitted except that a sled damaged beyond repair may be replaced if approved by an official. Once a sled has been left behind, it cannot be transported along the trail. It cannot be used again unless approved by the race marshal as a replacement for a broken sled. So, I hope you caught that there. They're allowed to use 3 different sleds, but only 2 may be shipped out on the trail. Of course, there is some strategy involved in that. If you think that you're going to be switching out sleds, you've got to have it shipped to the right place. And it's not just about the cost of having another sled constructed. Some of them do use really interesting materials. We've described Dallas Seavey's sled last year as sort of a Batmobile. But also, shipping out to these communities, out to these checkpoints, can be pretty expensive. So you might not want to ship 2 sleds out. Maybe you wouldn't even want to ship 1 out there and you just stick with the same sled throughout the race. You might have heard in there that they have the option of switching sleds between mushers. Sometimes there'll be kennel partners like Zirkel and Moore, or I've seen former handlers who were mushing teams out of the same kennel. One year it was Christian Turner mushing dogs in Dallas Seavey's kennel, and they might ask to use that other sled. They can switch those out, and of course, the person who's kind of positioned better to win the race or place highest up in the race, they need all the help that they can get, and that's one option that they can use, is to take a different sled. Sometimes the sleds get beat up and broken, and the musher might not have planned on having to switch out a sled, so that option of switching between mushers is in that rule book for a reason. So great question, and as always, we are hoping to get more questions from our listeners. You can send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We'll definitely take emails, but we really like those voice memos because we work in radio and we are all about sound. You just open up your voice memo app on your smartphone, record that question and send it on in, like I said, to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Last year, one of our podcast listeners asked what food our reporters were bringing with them, and we thought that was a question worth re-examining. Our trail reporters live somewhat unconventionally while they're hopping around chasing dogs for over a week, but they've got to eat. So, without further ado, here is the Iditapod's second installment of Snack Attack, now with Davis and Zach.
Yeah, so a question that somebody asked me was, what do you bring on the trail, or how do you eat? And the answer is, you eat what you can, when you can. And sometimes that means paying for meals in schools and, you know, buying a cheeseburger here and there. Or sometimes at community centers, people will bring in pots of moose stew or casseroles and stuff like that. But there's a lot of time in between, and so we pack a lot of snacks. So Davis, what snacks did you bring for the trail?
I think I honestly brought too many because I was weighing my bag and it was over 50 pounds, but I brought trail mix to like multiple gallon bags of trail mix.
What kind of trail mix? I mean, what are we talking here? Raisins, dried cranberries, cashews, good cashews?
Yeah, some great cashews mixed in with peanuts, those like yogurt covered beans, and some raisins in there as well. Yeah, dried fruit in a separate bag, banana chips, some Clif bars, my favorite flavors are peanut butter, chocolate chip, and then the dried cereal, which is basically Cheerios and some single servings of Raisin Bran.
That's a lot of snacks. Have you made a dent?
After 2 days, I'd say I've maybe eaten a half a pound of that food.
Well, I don't have my full snack pack here. I distribute it across different bags so that I have like primary, going to be out, just a quick snack pack, And then I got, you know, my overnight bag, and that's where most of my snacks are. And then I have an ancillary cooler that mostly stays in the plane, and that's got a lot of snacks. But I have my jacket here, and like we were talking about, you always have to have backup snacks. So what I have left from the end of the day are just backup snacks in my jacket. Hold this up. I'm going to go through the pockets. Okay. Feels weird to be doing this in a pantry. I have a chocolate bar that I got in McGrath with some ice cream.
Specifically a Butterfinger.
Yeah, well, it was sort of an impulse buy. I thought I'm gonna give myself a nice little treat after I file today, but there's no nutritional value in that. It's like psychological snack. This is the good stuff. This is caribou jerky or caribou snack sticks. And I brought about 4 pounds of this. And this is like good, healthy protein on the go. I'll usually eat 2 or 3 caribou sticks at a time. It's caribou from Kotzebue that we got up there in November and got it processed at Indian Valley Meats just south of Anchorage. But yeah, these are like subsistence Slim Jims as far as I'm concerned.
Oh yeah, thanks for sharing, by the way. That was delicious, yeah.
Yes, these are our favorite. I have a clementine buried somewhere that I hope isn't squished. And the reason for clementines is when they freeze, they get better. Like, they taste sweeter. They're better. They're not like apples. They don't get mealy. So definitely clementines as a fruit. I don't think it's here. I think it's out in my bag. But I'm like you. I bring a lot of trail mix. I didn't bring 5 pounds of trail mix, but I probably got a solid 2. And yeah, my other staple snacks are Zone bars, high in protein, kind of high in sugar, but you want that protein. I'm a protein snacker, so I think that's probably good as an installment of Snack Attack with Davis and Zach.
Did we talk about liquid snacks?
What's a liquid snack? Like baby food?
No, honestly, I meant to bring these and I completely forgot. They're like Gatorade type supplements that you add to water and stuff, but then there's also a rendition where you can do like an energy tablet.
That just sounds like stupid astronaut food stuff.
Probably, yeah, astronaut food. Perfect, yes.
Well,
why don't we have that?
I don't know why we don't have astronaut food. All right, thank you for listening to Snack Attack, Davis and Zach. We'll be right back.
And we're back. Astronaut food sounds fun. I know I love Tang. I've seen mushers carrying Tang out on the trail. But some of the tastiest food is moose meat, if you're into that sort of thing, and definitely the pie. We mentioned earlier the great food in Takatna. In the past, it's been steaks and always pies. And the village of only about 50 people is legendary as a hospitable checkpoint in that regard. This year, Takatna residents also served up a giant moose roast served for dinner Wednesday night with mashed potatoes and salad on the side. It sounds delicious. Zach found his way out of the pantry and into the crowded, noisy community center where dinner is served, and he spoke with an elder who shot the moose that fed the mushers.
What's your full name?
Dick Newton.
How old are you?
87.
And tell me about how'd you get the moose that we just all ate?
No, we hunt from a boat. And I got a cabin up the river 20 miles from here, and we hunt. We go up in the morning, up the river in the morning with the boat early, you know, and then come down after the sun goes down. See?
And how big a moose was this one?
I don't really remember how big, but it couldn't have been too big or I wouldn't have shot it. Because I'm a meat hunter. I'm not a damn trophy hunter.
How long you lived in Takatna?
45 years.
Do you hunt with your family?
Yeah, pretty much so, yeah. Oh, we invite a person or two, you know, different times. But that first opening weekend is pretty much family.
And how many moose in a year will you usually take for the family?
Oh, we try to get like 4 or 5 or 6 opening weekend.
And what did we just have? I mean, was it the roast or what all?
It was if it were a cut from a beef, they would call it a steamboat round.
It's like the femur, the back leg?
Yeah, it's the large part of the hip, you know.
That was 87-year-old Dick Newton, the Takotna resident who still moose hunts and this year provided the meat for Wednesday night's meal at the Iditarod checkpoint. And we've cleaned our plate here on the Iditapod. That's all we have time for today. Just a reminder, we're in the midst of our daily episode, so check back tomorrow morning for the next installment of the Iditapod. The last couple episodes went out a little late, I apologize for that, but the idea is to have those ready for you when you're getting up in the morning, maybe on your drive to work, having your coffee, what have you. You will find us on iTunes and other podcatcher apps, or you can listen online at alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove. Until next time, happy trails.
Casey, I just want you to know that I'm tracking this in a pantry under my jacket in the school. It smells like caribou jerky because that's what's in my coat, which has gotten very hot as I have it draped over my head and my laptop. So, just letting you know...